Welcome to Ever Beyond, Beyond. On Wolf Spirit Radio, No Borders Radio, and everbeyond.info. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond, 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 beyond. Once again, we're coming to you, Hermosa Beach, Elgin, Scotland, link up via the Earth Consciousness Network known as the Internet. We are broadcasting on 5 feet high poles, and anyway, listen, enough of that. Coast to coast, etc., shiny rose, the man who, and... My Batman to his Robin, my Veer to his Malari, my Lanier to his Glenn, my Lita to my Kosh. So anyway, listen, I got Sean David Morton once again. I'm going to tell that story. Just like being on Wednesday. Anyway, this is I'm very honoured once again to have Sean on my show. Without too much further ado, because everybody, everybody's listened to the archive or listened to the show that we did a few weeks ago when I've just started reading the book and I was getting well excited about it, and now, so hopefully people are kind of up to speed on the story of it, but I'd like to kind of really jump into it and see how, if we can, like, bring people really into what it's like to be inside that organization looking outwards at us. Welcome, Sean David Morton.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure and honor to be here, and I want to say thank you for inviting me. Thank you very much.
All right. Oh, I've got. Oh man, you posted a few. All right. Let me just read some of this because. hang on.
I posted my bio in your chat for this guy there, so.
That's right. Alien abductors have asked him to probe them. That's right. His legend precedes him the way lightning precedes thunder. His reputation is expanding faster than the universe. He lives vicariously through himself.
You can use all, you'll read them all. They're pretty funny. So
he once visited the psychic to warn. Yeah. Anyway, Sean, yep. The man, the one and only, as it were. So we are we're very delighted. I'm very delighted, and everybody in this room is delighted, even though she can't hear you yet. But I'll put the speakers on, so she'll be able
to
hear.
Okay. Thanks.
you can hear. She's got incredible... Actually, she's telepathic, so she's hearing vicariously through my spirit ears. This is my friend Fiona. Bless her heart.
Hi, Fiona. How are you?
My headphones are loud. That's, and she's got very sensitive ears.
Okay. So, anyway. Guten Nacht, meine Fraulein.
Oh, no, Fiona's Scottish.
She's Scottish. Okay, yeah. Well, you don't know me.
You don't know me.
Who do you think you are? You don't know me.
So, meanwhile, back in the dark. We kind of left it off. I don't know where were we?
Well, the exciting thing for me was that I listened to a show you did earlier with a chap from Ireland. What was the gentleman's name again?
Thomas Sheridan.
Thomas Sheridan, and yeah. We were listening to an interview by Paul Hellyer, who is the former.
Alan James,
who was the former Minister of Defense for Canada.
Yeah,
and the the thing for me was, is here you have a man who was tasked with obviously being brought into the group, if you will, for the protection of North America, and you know, who has access to all the secrets. And I mean, it would have been nice to ask him things like who controls Area 51, and I mean, had all these questions that I was putting to you in the chat that I know I was kind of out of line, because I was just very excited about possibly getting, you know, something through to be able to speak to him. Now he's going to be we're going to have him on a Wednesday, hopefully, on Strange Universe. And your show on the wolfspiritradio.com, the Wolf Chat, was actually great fun. And you know, but I had a list of questions like, the North Pole is moving. Is super tech being used to alter the nodal axis of the planet and cause prophylactic earthquakes to stabilize the Earth? Was the Norway spiral caused by IceCat, which is basically the Norse version of HAARP? Is a planetary defense system being put in place against an alien invasion in the next decade? And he said yes. Actually, he talked about how Star Wars was all part of that, where on the one hand he was saying that the defense mechanism was against the he said it's against the Russians. He said the Russians, the Chinese, and extraterrestrials as well. And a friend of mine that does a lot of research for my program, Ryan Velli, was a former captain in IT for the Canadian military, actually for the U.S. military, and he was up for a very high-level job at the Pentagon, in which they wanted him to write a report on future threats. And he wrote this report on the Russians and the Chinese as a future threat. And he was specifically told, when he handed in the report, thanks but no thanks, you know, no cigar for you, because we don't have to worry. This is what he was told by his guys at the Pentagon for a high-level job, that we don't have to worry about the Russians, we don't have to worry about the Chinese, that the next threat, the next war, is going to be with beings, with extraterrestrials, with beings from space. And they actually handed the job to a colonel from NASA, and that's when my friend Ryan basically got out of the military altogether and moved his family up to Quebec, up to Canada. And now he's living in Canada, and he's starting a business that's – he actually teaches computer science at McGill University up there, I think it is, after having access to all this IT stuff. But, you know, I wanted to ask him things like, you know, Eisenhower had an original meeting with in February of 1954 with a group called the Aetherians that were the Tall Whites. Then you had this stuff come out in the news. Weirdly enough, you actually had the Iranians quoting – Sorcha Falls website, whatdoesitmean.com, where the Iranians were saying that the world, and this was the big national news, this was on the Daily Show, for goodness sakes, where the Iranians were saying that these Tall Whites are running the world, or a council of them is running the world. And then he talked about he talked briefly, just to recap what he was saying. He said something about they investigated a fleet of craft that was moving across North America in the 60s, and of course my question was, well, what about on Unsolved Mysteries? They did a huge thing about these gigantic triangular ships that were being seen over Europe in Belgium. And the Belgian government actually came out and said, you know, we've got these things on radar, and they had video of them, which in my belief later turned out to be it's an American TR3. I can't say an American. I can see whoever. Yeah, it's the TR3B Astra. Yeah, the Astra is like has a quantum drive in the center, and it, you know, jumps from place to place and takes 8 people to man the thing. And there's all kinds of stuff on the net on it now, but we were seeing it out at Area 51 in 91, 92, and all that. And by the way, the book that he was trying to quote from Richard Dolan, who always wears a suit. Every time I see Richard, I was like, he's the best dressed man in ufology. I joke that he had a difficult birth. Until the doctor reached in and pulled him out of the birth canal by his tie. And so his book is actually called AD, After Disclosure, When the Government Finally Reveals the Truth About Alien Contact. That's Richard Dolan's book that you were looking for. And in the other part of this is that I also thought it was interesting, and I hate to all quote his stuff, but here's a guy who's the official source on this. He did say that they were taking a prophecy by the extraterrestrials very seriously that I guess came to them in 1974, and why it was put out like this, I don't know. But they were saying that, they were saying 30 years plus 10, why they wouldn't just say 40 years, but 30 years plus 10, that there were going to be great changes on the planet. And, of course, that is this year, 2014. And what I was trying to convey in the chat here is, for my entire life, I've been trying to figure out this one particular unique feature of the Great Pyramid of Giza, having, you know, spent the night there three times and having mystical experiences inside the pyramid all the way back in when I was a kid in Egypt in 1974. And when you enter the pit, which is 151 feet beneath the pyramid itself, you stand up. If you understand the time coding of the pyramid, that as you enter the pyramid, the entrance door of the chamber of the pyramid directly aligns with Thuban, which at that time was known as the Dragon Star, because it was in the constellation of Alpha Draconis, which is in there. This is where David Icke gets a lot of his mythology. Well, it all comes from the Egyptians. The Egyptians are the whole overview of history, which is what Sands of Time is about as well, is that there is a spiritual conflict, if you will, a conflict of choice of whether or not to choose good or evil every day, which is, by the way, a power denied to the angels, the Bible says. But this choice of doing good or evil every day is what is based upon this war between the lords of light and the gods of darkness, if you will, that are represented by Isis and Osiris and Horus and
Set.
Yeah, well, no, and then versus the serpent gods, which are supposedly from Alpha Draconis, that Horus and his gang, that Isis and Osiris were from Sirius A, a copper race, and actually supposedly. If you look at, I mean, and this is just once again hearsay, I'm not like a contactee or an abductee or any kind of E, that the red races or the copper races come from Sirius A, the black races come from Sirius B, with their progenitors being the Dogon tribes, primarily from Gabon, Africa, where they were seated on the planet at some point. And that's interesting because Sirius, we just learned that Sirius was a binary star sometime in the late 50s, early 60s or so, and the two stars rotate around each other, strangely enough, at 33 and a third, which is another weird reason why records actually rotate at 33 and a third, which is another little mystery there. But it takes 33.3 years for the two stars to rotate around each other. And the Dogon tribe have all these festivals and all these things that have to do with 33 and a third. So the black races come from Sirius B. The Asian races, and this goes all the way back to, Chariots of the Gods and Eric von Daniken, we believe come from Epsilon Eridani. And Epsilon Eridani went supernova about 100,000 years or so ago. And the theory is that they traveled here inside the Great Pearl, which is the moon. And that there's a corridor of some kind between here and Epsilon Eridani, and then they parked the moon in orbit and then supposedly abandoned it there, although there seems to be a lot of other things going on there. And that the various Caucasoid races of the planet all came from most recently from the Pleiades. And the Pleiadians before that came from the constellation of Lyra. And all of the races, and this goes into the Billy Meyer material, all of the races of this universe apparently escaped another collapsing universe and all came in through the Ring Nebula, which is in Lyra, which explains all of the stuff going on here. So in the Great Pyramid, there's a battle for the soul of man, where you have one group that is going all the way down, 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 down into the pit. Well, when you enter the pyramid, the time coding of the pyramid is that a pyramid, I guess you'd call it a sacred cubit, which is about it's about 26 inches, but it's about from the middle of your arm to your index finger. And obviously whoever's building the pyramid was much bigger at that time, but that's 26 inches or so. And then when you enter the chambers, the time coding changes from cubits to inches, representing years. So when you enter the pit, you stand up approximately the year 1900. If you just walk forward, without care, between the years, there's a lip on the pit. So between the years, approximately, and there's a plus minus of 3 years of all this, but between the years approximately 2004, December, the later part of the year of 2004, through about 2008, there would be a series of warnings to mankind that would be, aquatically based. And isn't it weird that in December of 2004, we have the Asian tsunami, which kills 250,000 people. A year later, we have Katrina, which, of course, not only kills people but wipes out this entire area of the United States. Then we have the economic collapses and whatever else. But this would be the beginning, that those who could see the handwriting on the wall would turn right or towards God or towards the creation or towards the ascension, that we would get through 2012 with everything being okay. And then we would think we would be fine. And then something happens between now, late 2012, because all these things seem to start in December, and approximately late 2016, that is a gigantic trough that's called the River of Fire, which is bigger than the First and Second World Wars combined. It's like everything bad ever in the history of humanity kind of all at once. It's some kind of game changer or game ender, and it's called the River of Fire. And this River of Fire is either could possibly have been a planetary flip, a massive earthquake of some kind. You know, I mean, for example, if California was to fall in the ocean, you would have a tidal wave that would go around the world several times. It would possibly be 1,000 feet high. So that's the big question as to what's been going on with that and whether or not this was the $64,000 question for Mr. Hellyer, which, you know, I was hoping that you guys had asked. I felt as though the host of the show, and I'm sure he's a very bright fellow, and it seems like he was just filling up the spaces with a lot of, you know, his opinion. When you have one of the most invaluable sources, I mean, that's like getting Donald Rumsfeld or, you know, President Bush on your show to say, you know, what exactly happens, and then kind of foisting your opinions on him, you know, without letting him talk. I mean, I kept wanting to know who runs Area 51, and you got that question in at the very end, and he said, well, that's the cabal. And if the cabal has that kind of power, and, you know, he went off on zero point energy and all these other things, and which was kind of interesting, but, the difference, and I think this is what you probably realized in Sands of Time, is that there seems to be a group of autocrats that are very busy building us a cage, a 1984, you know, boot stamping on a human face for 1,000 years sort of dystopia, and a difference between people that are dealing with the tech, which is, I always look at it as corporate technology in the R&D level is maybe 3 to 5 years ahead of what they've got on the market. Then you have a military level of technology that seems to be about 10, maybe 15 years ahead. It's shorter than that now. I would think about 5 to 10 years ahead of what goes on the market. And then you get into the really scary stuff. Then you get into Area 51. Then you get into the scout ships and the flying saucers that can appear and disappear. And what I've seen with my own eyes, the 1,600 foot long shuttles, the shuttle that I saw, 1,600 feet from tip to tail. And this thing flew right over my head like giant mothership, at Area 51. And then you get into the stuff that Gary McKinnon found out. And I know Gary's just been completely buried, but Gary McKinnon in the late 90s was talking about when he used some Ukrainian software to hack the Pentagon databases and found an entire list of what he called the extraterrestrial navy, which, interestingly enough, they jokingly call it the Nebraska Navy, because it was all being run out of the Strategic Air Command in Omaha, and now everything's been shifted to King's Peak. The U.S. Space Command is now under a place called the King's Peak in the Uinta National Forest in Utah. Everything got moved to Utah.
That's right. But what was surprising about the whole space thing is that everybody assumes that the space thing is going to be the Air Force. But it's not, because it's the Navy, because they travel in space ships, don't they?
Yeah. And notice.
And it's always, in Star Trek, it's always nautical terms they're using.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, look at the, the people that run Area 51 is the Office of Naval Intelligence, is ONI. If you look at the largest naval bases in the United States, they're all in the desert. We have China Lake, which is a huge naval weapons testing area. And I asked my guy, Ted Humphrey, once, I'm like, well, why does the Navy have all these bases in the desert? And his joke was, well, lizards like the desert. That was his joking response.
Yeah, when I was first married about 18 years ago.
To a lizard?
No, sorry. To a lizard. Well, we won't go into that. But when we first lived there, we lived in Wiltshire, and we thought we'd go to a really nice place where there was nothing going on, no weirdness. And then we discovered that we lived above RAF Rudlow Manor.
Oh, my goodness.
Which had no aeroplanes, but was the Air Force, you know.
Right.
And it turns out that this is the underground base where, because the land is made of chalk, and it's really, like a limestone stuff. Bath is made of the stuff because they ordered the whole stuff to be mined out and cut into blocks to be to made into the, all the buildings of Bath. So the whole Bath was made of the build of the stone that was came out of the underground base, and there were people who used to do the electricity and stuff, and they said, "Oh yeah, there's a whole city down there, and they got swimming pools and cinemas and pubs and everything, a whole city." And this is where one of the places that I'd like you to take us, for instance, inside in the book Sands of Time. We're brought inside the different bases. The first base we come across is this very James Bond scenario in the Arctic island. And then there's a further base that they start building some of the reverse engineered tech, you know, much later. Do you want to take it? What's your favorite base? You know, is it Groom Lake where the UFOs are stored? What's your favorite base, Sean?
Well, I guess... in Sands of Time, the first base that Ted goes to, he gets his first assignment is he's probably the only guy bright enough who understands the physics enough to actually be able to break down, Herr Dr. General Hans Kammler. And Hans Kammler.
Übergruppenführer, yeah.
Yeah, the Übergruppenführer. This man controlled at one point 14 million people in Europe. He was the one who set up all the logistics, if you will, for all of the concentration camps. He ran 9, I guess you would say, alternative technology or super technology bases, mostly in Eastern Europe. And he was the most powerful man in Europe outside of Hitler in Germany. And he disappears, completely just vanishes off the face of the earth in April of 1945. When you then discover at one point he'd fallen into the hands of the Americans and the Russians. And that we sort of traded him back and forth because nobody could crack him. He was one of the few that knew the secrets because he was the one that found, apparently, I guess as a corporal, found what later became known as the Nazi Bell, stumbled across a crash spaceship of some kind in the Black Forest of Bavaria, I think it was, Austria. And he was cracking this thing open and trying to figure out how it worked and working with the gravity fields of it, and began to realize that you could use these gravity fields for time travel, teleportation, but you could also use, he also tore open a hole in the time-space continuum, which then was the precursor for an invasion of this reality, ripping open a hole in the fence that had been put around planet Earth for our protection at some time, at some point in the pre-antediluvian past. It was that. So we needed Kammler to tell us, give us the equations that we needed to complete to start plugging up these holes and completing these devices in order to alter time. So that one up at I think it was Mount Grace, I think it was, in the Arctic, was then annihilated by the Russians and what they claimed to be an unscheduled nuclear test, when it was in fact a nuclear submarine that they blew up to try to keep Ted Humphrey from escaping. Number two would be probably, then what does he see next? He sees Area 51. Now, Area 51 is strange because there's, you have a lot of revelations coming out about guys who worked at Area 51 or Groom Lake or the Docktown Strip, as it used to be called. And they worked there in the early 60s when, yeah, part of them were developing the U-2 spy planes and the SR class of spy planes. SR stands for Surveillance and Reconnaissance. And they were developing the SR-71 and the Blackbird and all that, which was traveling at Mach 3 at least by 1962 or 63. But then you have everything sort of segmented. Then, you know, the real big one that goes all the way back to the 50s and early 60s is then Montauk in upstate New York. And Montauk is interesting because the Montauk Indians believed that the location where the Montauk Lighthouse is, that Montauk is the navel of the world, and that the universe was created outwards from this area in Montauk. And there were very specific energies about it. Thomas Jefferson was fascinated by the Montauk Indians because they spoke a language that, for all intents and purposes, was ancient Egyptian. And this was, Jefferson was about 30 years before we actually discovered the Rosetta Stone, which of course had Arabic and Egyptian hieroglyphs and I think Koine Greek, which we could translate. And so he was actually writing out, he spent most of the rest of his life actually trying to figure out the Montauk Indians language because he felt that this was a key to be able to unlock the Egyptian mystery. So at Montauk, and you've got a lot of really wild stories about Montauk that mostly come from Peter Moon, but you do have a base there up at what they call Camp Hero. And Peter Moon has a whole series of books on the Montauk Project and time travel and what they called the Montauk Chair, and that they had to use prepubescent or boys right at the edge of puberty because their electromagnetics hadn't set or something to project them somewhere in the future, and you know, to where this horse was at a plaza with a clock in its belly and all that. But that's the that's a whole other thing. But Area 51 sits on top of a gigantic underground facility. I mean, the federal government owns probably 89% of Nevada. And as a matter of fact, most people don't understand that the quote federal government, which is the United States Incorporated, which really only is Washington D.C., Puerto Rico, American Samoa, Guam, military bases and post offices, the federal government owns probably 80% of the land west of the Mississippi, which is completely separate from the ownership of the sovereign states. So the ones that I talk about is we talk about Area 51, an underground facility at Area 51, but 51 did not really play into a lot of this until they moved the saucers there, because they moved the UFOs. They had 9 UFOs that were just kind of sitting around at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base that they requested be moved to a hangar at 51, a special area called S4, which is about 30 miles. You got to go through a pass, and then you go to another lake bed, which is called Papoose Lake. And they built a dune-colored hangar into the side of the mountains to basically house these nine captured ships.
And they were like a series of garage doors, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. But they went down several levels. There was more stuff there. There were 9 separate sections. They then connect, and they all connected through sort of offices at the far end of the hangars. The floor on each one of these sections actually then elevated down to level 2. And in level 2, they would then take the saucers and they would put the saucers into these bays. And the bays had these kind of like planks or platforms that would come out, and they would come all the way out into it, and they would kind of take the shape of the saucer so that you could sort of monkey bar your way around the saucers. And then everything was lit like almost like if you were painting a car. Everything, the lighting was all 360 degrees so that they could see different things around this and work on these ships. Then you had level 3, which was like lunch facilities and security. It was where the scientists could hang out. Then level 4 was where most of the security personnel were, and there were like 7 security guards for every scientist who was working on the project. And then you had level 5, and level 5 was once again more security, but one half of it was what they called ambassadorial suites, which were various containment facilities that were designed to be vacuum sealed. They could pump different types of gases into them, and these were for actual living extraterrestrials. The only ones that I knew of were 2 at the time, one of which died. Well, they both died, but they were taken in a crash in South Africa from a crash in the Kalahari, and one of these creatures survived, and they were trying to communicate with it, and that's where we got our a famous piece of footage that I was brought in on actually to take a look at by my friend Jeff Broadstreet and Rocket Video, that later became known as the alien interview. And this was 2 minutes and 55 seconds of a piece of video that was smuggled out by a man called the Mysterious Victor. And you guys, now you can see it on YouTube everywhere. But it's a filmed interview with a living extraterrestrial that's behind a glass, that's in a glass enclosure, And the only reason this interview is particularly unique is because the alien has a he has a seizure on camera, and while they're trying to communicate with it using what they call an intcom, which are, you know, intuitive communicators, which, again, we don't know if they're really communicating with them. We don't know if they're and again, do we communicate when you pat your dog on the head and say good boy? Are you communicating with your dog? That was pretty much the level of it. The things that we did learn from the extraterrestrial was that they did not view that they were a hive consciousness. They did not do, they did not view life individually as we did. They did not see dying as a big thing because they just went into the group mind. They had a single lung heart structure. The brain was just amazing. It was just one, it wasn't bicameral. It wasn't split into two sections like ours were. Very sensitive to light because they had the very large eyes and all that. But they, what eventually killed them was microbacteria that was building up in their lungs because they just couldn't. I mean, they ate kind of an algae that we fed them. And when I say we, the royal we or whoever the Americans were there, and they ate sort of this weird algae, like a spirulina, if they will. We actually had to, we fed them. They also liked strawberry ice cream, which is very strange because we had to, they had to funnel it through a bunch of different things to get bacteria out and all that. But it eventually died of a microbial infestation in its lungs. It just couldn't breathe. So, anyway, moving forward, then you had, probably the most famous base, was the Dulce Archuleta Mesa. And the Dulce Mesa, my investigations into the Dulce Mesa, which physically proved it was there, and I you know, I tried to present this stuff to MUFON, to Walt Andrus, and that bunch, and unless you're Linda Moulton Howe or Stanton Friedman and his beard, they were not interested in anybody outside of their approved core of people. And I, you know, and since then I've spoken to people and interviewed people that used to be big directors of MUFON who eventually just quit in disgust. And there's a reason why I call MUFON the morons ultimately finding out nothing, because it doesn't matter how good your research is. If you give it to MUFON, they will find a way to bury it. And, I mean, MUFON should, for all intents and purposes, MUFON should have a show on TV about all their files and all their cases, and somebody, if they had any brains, would connect into the MUFON guys and just do a reality show about, you know, all the good stuff and act as a clearinghouse for all these kind of interesting things. So the Dulce Mesa was kind of a weird thing because there was a guy by the name of Charles Berlitz. And Charles Berlitz was famous for being the Berlitz language tape guy. And Berlitz was fascinated by the Bermuda Triangle, and he brought in I laughingly call him a UFO researcher, but a guy named Bill Moore, who had had a prison background for some rather nefarious, you know, nasty stuff that he did. And, but Moore came out and started releasing information about the Dulce Mesa and about the war and about other things. And then, and John Lear and Bill Cooper released a report about Dulce, that they said was actually by an alien named O.H. Krill. They just made the name up, by the way. They just thought it was funny to call it O.H. Krill, which later on Bill Cooper then said was a real name that he saw in the Navy files, which, according to John Lear, was completely untrue, and this was in the area where Bill just started making stuff up. So in my investigations into Dulce, the original person who started looking into it was Lieutenant Colonel Wendell Stevens. And I mean, we believe that this is probably because he looked into Dulce that this is why he went to jail, because Wendell spent 5 years in prison for a period of time. And but some weird things were going on. So in Wendell's research, he actually found two engineers who had actually built the Dulce Mesa in the early 1950s as either a gigantic bomb shelter where they were hollowing out a pre-existing cave, they were going to use it for a nuclear waste facility. And the governor of New Mexico said, no, we've got enough of our own atomic bombs. Thank you very much. They have 2,600 nuclear weapons in a hill outside of Kirtland Air Force Base, which is public knowledge. I mean, you can see the doors that lead to this whole area. So he said, no more nuclear waste. Thank you very much. So the theory then goes is that the U.S. government decided, well, we're not just going to leave it sit there. And they figured it was remote enough and isolated enough that they then began using Dulce apparently sometime in the mid-60s as a genetic research facility. Now, as far as we know, the progression of the alien contact, and I'm sure there's a lot more out there, but this is what we can prove, it begins with Dwight Eisenhower in February of 1954 where Eisenhower is golfing one day. He claims to have a dental problem. They whisk him away to Muroc Air Force Base, which is currently called Edwards Air Force Base in California because he was in Palm Springs. And it was there that Bishop McIntyre, who was head of the Los Angeles Archdiocese, and a man named Gerald Light, both of whom have done sworn statements to this, by the way, met with a group of ETs who called themselves the Tall Whites, which they called the Etherians. And they called them the Etherians because they had these devices on their belts that they could apparently turn on and turn off, and they could appear and disappear. And they demonstrated their ship, which, of course, you know, these scientists were vomiting because they couldn't understand how it worked and all this. And the bottom line is they offered Eisenhower a deal. They said, we will give you technology. We will help your ascension. We will help your planet in any way we can, but you have to give up your nuclear weapons. And they explained that the nuclear weapons were basically blasting holes in the time-space continuum, that they were burning holes in dimensions, that they were just damaging space. And Eisenhower, probably his thought process was, number one, he knew at that time that Hitler had escaped. He knew that Hitler had super-secret weapons. For all he knew, he was talking to a bunch of Germans who had probably fled to Antarctica or Brazil and had come up with this, and even if it wasn't Germans, he thought, well, if they're afraid of our nuclear weapons, and that's the only way we can defend ourselves against whoever this is, remember we just come out of a world war with, you know, Germany and Japan, then thanks but no thanks, and he turns their offer down. At the end of the meeting, the Tall Whites then say, well, we also want you to know that another group is here. Apparently two of these groups showed up at the same time, through two separate rifts in the universe, one probably being from the Philadelphia experiment, and the other one, the other one being,
a rift in space time has just opened up.
Yeah, the rift in space time. Well, I don't know if you stand by 1 second.
Okay. So, well, there you go. Eisenhower, was at a particular juncture there because not only did he have the extraterrestrial problem, he also had the, Tibetans coming over saying that they wanted to incarnate the being that, we call the Christ. Sean, okay. Did you get any of that?
Yeah, I did, all of it.
This is
an interesting thing. The last thing you said was very interesting because it's that directly relates to I lived in a monastery in Nepal.
I'm aware. Go ahead.
And the Nepalese, well, the black hats that I lived with, who were the Karma Kagyu monks, they left Tibet in the 8th century with a prophecy, and their prophecy was that eventually the great dragon of China would wake up and would destroy the land of snow and drive the ocean of wisdom, which is the Dalai Lama, from the land of snow, and that there would be a great murder, a great, you know, culling, if you will, of the monks and whatever else, and that they would all, through a transmigration of souls, were all going to come to the land of the red man, and that the true religion would take hold in the land of the red man, being America. And of course, between 55 and 65, the Red Chinese invaded, and they killed about 4 million Tibetans, I think, which was, considering the whole population of Tibet was, I think, only 6.5 million, 7 million at that time. They slaughtered a little bit over half the population. And they claim that this is all necessary for a transmigration of souls to happen, for them to all come to North America, which is another reason why the Dalai Lama is so popular here, and
that's
why
right.
They said this big transmigration of souls was occurring. So
that's right. So, these three Tibetans approached Eisenhower. They approached Truman. It was before.
Okay.
They approached Truman, and they said, "We've got the being that you call the Christ, and that you call the Christ, and he's been here for 2,000 years. He's never left the planet, you know. And he and his students want to incarnate in America. This is the plan so far. You know, this is our plan, right? We've got this idea. And if you could set aside a piece of land that would be, you know, quiet and protected, because these are very sensitive beings, and you know all this stuff." They could do that, and Truman actually agreed, and he set aside a place which they called Shangri-La, after the Shambhala, which is the holy city, which is like the etheric counterpart to the government of the real God, if you like. The election came up, and Truman lost. And Eisenhower came in, and he saw these monks walking around in red. And being a Baptist, he decided that they were all demons. And
actually, hold on one second. Yeah. Truman didn't lose the election. He was at the end of his. Eisenhower ran against Adlai Stevenson, so he was at the end of his.
All right. So yeah, sorry, I'm not that good with the Americans.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, you're not from here.
Yeah, I know. That's right. I'm not from these parts. So anyway, we after the Eisenhower gets in, he decides that these guys are the devil, and then he has to deal with the extraterrestrials, and of course, being a military mind rather than a sort of spiritual mind, he sold out the entire human race. So that's what I've got to say about Ike.
And that's then part two of this is that the rest of the story goes is that after he turned down the after he supposedly turned down the tall whites. And there's a lot of other stories to this too. Frank Strange just talks about the Stranger at the Pentagon with Valiant Thor, that they were Venusians that were actually in contact with him, and you know, all through the government and all this. And then Richard Dolan is actually doing an interview with a guy with cancer who worked at Area 51 and who's confirming a lot of this stuff in a lot of these meetings. And the second meeting occurs. The tall whites warn him that there's a gray mothership out there. And that the gray mothership is that they're going to be contacting at some point in the future as well. And this happens apparently in November of 1954. And at that time, the grays appear that supposedly are from Zeta Reticuli. And the Zeta Reticulans come in and say, well, we don't care if you blow up nuclear bombs. You know, you blow yourself smithereens. We want all we want is genetic material. We're at the end of a genetic breeding spiral or what have you. And we just want to be able to abduct a few people, take some samples. We'll wipe their minds. No harm, no foul. We'll put them back with no memory. And, you know, but we just want genetic material. And in exchange for that, we'll give you technology. And Eisenhower's like, okay, sure. And thinking to himself, well, we couldn't stop them if they wanted to take it anyway, so why not profit from it? Then there's a lot of other research on that as well, because this is in essence also what's in the files that are shown to Bob Lazar when Bob Lazar goes to Area 51. It's in a really interesting book, which is called, Contact with Serpo, S-E-R-P-O, which is supposedly about our astronauts who then go to Zeta Reticuli and live there for a period of time, but that's all neither here nor there. Anyway, in the case of Dulce, what happens is that we now open a facility that has a huge dome at the top that has seven levels going down, and the entire Dulce facility is all color-coded, because apparently the extraterrestrials are colorblind. So we do the whole thing kind of as a sneaky trick. We do the whole thing color-coded, with red level one being at the top as the root chakra, if you will, and then going down to the basement, which is violet level seven. And we, in essence, in this co-existence that we have with them, we give levels four through seven to this group of extraterrestrials to do whatever they want down there. They have a liaison, which is a Nordic type. In my book, he's called Lord Tugi, and he acts as a liaison for the grays in the lower levels for him to be able to then interact with the human scientists up at the top. And we are told that they are doing genetic research down in these lower levels. Dulce was fairly famous for its genetic research, its hybridization of beings and creatures and what have you. And there were two conflicts. This was not a very happy thing. Something happened in 1977 where there was a misunderstanding between a guard who entered a room armed. One of the grays freaked out. Something happened, and there was a small skirmish in 77 that resulted in, I think the deaths of four of our personnel and a few of them. And things got tense for a while, and it wasn't until, and this is where it gets very interesting, because where my information and then Phil Schneider, that you can look up on the web, started then interconnecting. It was really strange, because after I wrote Sands of Time, I went back and I looked at Phil Schneider's material. Phil was murdered in February of 96, where he was talking about how he was one of the mole men and how he was one of the people that was also responsible for the retrofit on the World Trade Centers, where after the 93 truck bombing, he was one of the guys who went in. And he said this, you know, many years before 9/11 happened. He said that he was one of the people that went in and put thermite charges on this thing so that it could either be, so the whole thing could be detonated and demolished in the future if that was needed, Ori put kill switches in, so if the building swayed more than 20 degrees, if they were hit by another truck bomb, because the whole impetus of the first truck bomb in the basement at 9/11 was to collapse one of the buildings and have it fall into the other building and have the whole thing kind of fall down. And in case that was to happen, this is according to Schneider, in case it was to happen, they put these explosives, you know, they pre-armed them. And the person that supervised this entire project, which people don't understand, the guy that was responsible for the retrofit and security for the World Trade Center's complexes and for the Dulles International Airport for almost 10 years was Marvin Pierce Bush, who is George Bush's younger brother, and another guy that was their cousin. I forget what his name was. Delano, I think Warren Delano, I think it was, who's, because the Bushes are all also related to the Franklin Delano Roosevelt and that whole family, because it's all, you know, they're all intermingled. So that's another explanation for the whole World Trade Center thing that Schneider was talking about. What Schneider said was that he was one of the mole men that was responsible for drilling these tunnels underground to create a massive private underground railway system for the U.S. government to use, one, just to ferry leaders back and forth, and they called it the Red Line, which went east and west, and the Blue Line, which went north and south. And these were amazingly advanced, high-speed, supersonic trains. They were made out of porcelain. The outer shells were porcelain because the electromagnetic buildup would be great, so they needed to make them out of non-ferrous materials. And these things went 750, 800 miles an hour underground. And so when they were finally completing the line from the east and the west, and Dulce was the golden spike, if you will, Schneider talked about how when they broke through, they found this abattoir under Dulce of thousands of headless human skeletons. And this then interconnects with my book, Sands of Time, where my character, Ted Humphrey, is then called by one of these teams that says you need to go underneath Dulce and see what they're up to down there. Because we had suspected for a while after the skirmish in 77, when a bunch of our guys died of radiation poisoning, that they weren't doing genetics down there. They were doing something else. And we discovered that they were kidnapping human beings and using a process to basically boil them down into soup to store them as food for what might be a future invasion. And all of this, all of these, and I was told that trillions of dollars would disappear between 2008 and about 2012. And that's exactly what happened in 2008 when $3.5 trillion disappeared out of the world economy on September 11th of 2008, between 9 a.m. and 11 a.m. Just to tell you who was behind it. I mean, that's what triggered the entire collapse. And had the computers not shut down, when they did, I mean, they would have taken it all. They would have taken, you know, $7-8 trillion, and Western civilization as we know it would have just disappeared.
It's like someone pulled the ripcord out.
Yeah, they did. They used something called the Promise software to basically, because it's all backdoored into the computers, and Promise is it's a form of artificial intelligence that's become very advanced. It was invented by a guy named Bill Hamilton in the 1980s. It stands for Prosecutor's Office Management Information System. And it was originally supposed to be a way to track criminals through the Department of Justice system, you know, through the FBI and the CIA and the IRS and financial crimes and immigration and all that kind of stuff. And now it's being used, for all intents and purposes, Promise became alive in 1998, and it's developed into an awesomely powerful artificial intelligence program that they're using for all kinds of creepy stuff. But so what happened with Dulce was that we finally got our guys finally got the go ahead from Reagan when they finally let Reagan in on the whole story. And Reagan said, you know, go get him. And, you know, we went in and cleared it out. We were getting our asses kicked too, by the way, and something very strange happened, which may or may not have been intervention from people from the future, but some kind of implosion weapon was used and cleaned out the base. Now I get in there in 89, because I went with a scientific team that consisted of Jim Delatoso and Paul Shepard and Dr. Fred Bell and all this, and we ultrasounded the mesa, and it gets back to Bill Moore again, because Bill Moore had said that he had just completely made up Dulce, that the whole story about Dulce was a lie, and that he was an agent for the government, and that he was a double agent, and that he made up this whole story and released it into the world just to show people how stupid UFO investigators can be. And we took offense at that, so we went out and sounded the Mesa and ran it through 75 hours of Cray supercomputer time in a process that was developed by Dr. Jim Dellatoso, who was with us on the team, of what was called data tabling, where we took slices of sound, if you will, processed them all through a computer, and we got a holographic map of the facility. And there it was. It had a nuclear core at its center. There was serious radiation coming out of the middle of it. It was everything that we thought it was. It had a huge dome shape at the top, and then you had floors that were probably 15 feet high and, seven levels, and there were actually tubes that had things coming and going from it when we ultrasounded the Mesa in December of 89. So whatever they did in the mid 80s, I think about 84, clearing the base out, they must have gone back in and done something else or reactivated the facility, somehow, some way. So as far as underground bases go, that's, and then the big one is supposedly under King's Peak in Utah, which is the new U.S. Space Command. Strategic Air Command has a big one. There's NORAD that they also call Crystal Palace, which they supposedly shut down in Colorado Springs, and now it's all being operated from somewhere else. But it's you had an interest in underground bases. There's your top five, I guess, of underground facilities. And
five. What about Tracy Island, Sean?
I don't know anything about it. I mean, I don't know anything about it.
You know Thunderbirds.
Oh, yeah, Thunderbirds. Tracy Island, of course, I'm sorry. That's... You're expecting me to reach back a little far in my memory.
Remember when we were young.
Yes, for Marionette Vision or whatever it was.
Super
Marionette Vision. Yeah, yes, yeah. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The point of all this being is that on the one hand, you have Eisenhower who comes in. And please understand that for people out there that don't think this is possible, understand that the Cold War was a hoax. The Cold War was a complete fraud. It was the same people that were running the Soviets, that were running the United States. They conned you all into thinking that nuclear war was going to happen any minute, which was completely nonsensical. It was never going to come down that way. The same forces that created and financed the Soviets and the Chi-Coms and turned the 20th century into one giant war. If you look at the 20th century, it was one giant war where the populations basically just stopped long enough to repopulate and rearm and then go at it again. And when it wasn't against the Germans, then it was against the Koreans, then it was against the Vietnamese, then it was against... So, strangely enough, the longest extended period of peace and prosperity in human history was between 1991 and 2001. There was not a single war between two countries for 10 years. There were two civil wars. There was Rwanda and Burundi, which was just stupid. They killed 1.6 million people in 6 weeks, which is more people that have died in a shorter period of time than ever. But because it's Africa, nobody cares, I guess. And then you had Bosnia, Serbia, Herzegovina, which is the same civil war that's been going on for 100 years. So there's not a single war. I mean, they really had to think.
Yeah.
They really had to scratch their heads to come up with a war and a conflict. And because again, Nixon's whole thing was if America doesn't have an external enemy, it would turn on itself and rip itself apart. And that's exactly what you're seeing now. I think it's a good thing because people want independence. But, without somebody to pick on, there's nothing really unifying the United States. So, again, your other guest on the other show was asking Paul Hellyer about Project Bluebeam, which is kind of silly, but Bluebeam is, it's a holographic projection using sound and light to basically scare the enemy. It's, look, there's Allah 100 feet high telling us to surrender to the Americans, or, ooh, there's Moses telling us we have to give up. Everybody talks about a fake extraterrestrial invasion or a fake messianic invasion. I'm like, okay, and then what happens after that? We just have a fake Jesus ruling everybody, and it just gets very strange. So, and I am of the contention as well, and it doesn't make me real popular in the fear porn movement out there. But I do have now. I guess we're like the number two most popular radio show on the web behind, and now we're actually beating Alex Jones, actually, which is kind of fun. So
no,
maybe people are tired.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, beating Alex Jones. Actually, it's weird because Alex is number two because he has two websites that people visit. He's got InfoWars and Prison Planet, but somehow anybody that clicks on the website, they somehow actually tag that in the ratings as a listener. So if you actually look at Alex's actual show, his actual talk show was like 3,049 out of 10,000. But InfoWars, Prison Planet, Alex Jones is at number two because people click the website. And the minute you click the website, they count those people as tune-ins or listeners. But yeah, Strange Universe is like 77 now out of 10,000 radio stations, which means we're kicking Alex Jones's ass, which is kind of fun. I mean, it's kind of cool because maybe people are now, you know, because my crazy thing is that not everything's going to be okay, but you have a group of people at the top, as weird as it sounds, that all I see them doing is altering time in our favor. If you understood the Y2K phenomenon, there was $1 trillion that was spent beginning in 96 and 97 to fix the various Y2K problems. If you understood the phenomenon of polar drift, where magnetic north in 1945 became untethered from the center of the earth and started marching north because we knocked the planet off kilter using massive testing of nuclear weapons and hydrogen bombs and cobalt bombs and all that stuff. We knocked the earth off its orbit. It's like throwing a shoe into a washing machine. And the Rand Corporation was doing reports in the 50s and 60s that if true north and magnetic north were to meet, that the planet would either go through an electromagnetic shift to the poles, which would be disastrous because it would end modern civilization as we know it. If the poles were to shift magnetically, everything connected to a ground wire would fry because we have this weird hybrid electrical system that's part Nikola Tesla's genius, which is alternating current generators or AC and a high frequency electrical power being transmitted, you know, over vast distances from place to place. And then you have Thomas Edison who comes along and he puts a transformer on to be able to then change the frequency so it goes in your house so that you can then hang a meter on it and not get free power. You know, like J.P. Morgan's thing about, well, so anybody can put up an antenna and get free energy. Well, get Mr. Edison in here. And that was the big difference. So now everything we have that works at 60 cycles, I think it might be 40 cycles in Europe, so but 50, we have to
50 over him.
Yeah, it's 50 cycles there, but it's 60 cycles here. But you got to plug a ground wire in at 7.83 hertz, which is the Shulman resonance, to make it work. And the minute you shift the Shulman resonance, you fry everything, which then plays into the Hopi prophecy, because the Hopis do have a prophecy that our own mechanical devices will attack us and be responsible for our end, which is, of course, everything electrical in your house blowing up. And then suddenly, all of the same 100 people that were at Nelson Mandela's weird fake funeral in South Africa going to worship the nameless god at this Pentagon-shaped building, the same 100 people that were at probably the greatest satanic ritual working that I have ever seen in my life, which is the opening ceremonies of the London Olympics in 2012, complete with Lucifer in the form of the Queen of England falling from the sky, where at the very end she pretends to jump out of an airplane and parachutes with a British flag into the Olympics, were all there when Barack Obama got his ridiculous Nobel Peace Prize on December 9th of 2009, where they witnessed the Norway Spiral. And the Norway Spiral was created, I have all the proof and all the stuff and all the power generations, it was created by something called EISCAT, which is the Scandinavian version of HAARP. It's the incoherent, electric incoherent, scattered radiation array, and it somehow created a 0-point black hole energy field between us and the sun, which actually pulled energy off the sun and then altered the nodal axis of the earth. So now suddenly true north, instead of marching towards true north, is now heading due, east towards Siberia. So, which means now we don't have to worry about the planet tipping over. So that's a big one. The next thing we had to worry about was the sun, and there have been planet-sized ships that have been spotted by SOHO. This is when you see all this stuff interacting somehow with the sun, pulling energy off the sun. But this is, and meanwhile, the biggest thing that Mr. Hellyer needs to know is that the quote cabal At the same time, one half of them are creating these political prisons, which are basically all just corporations. And when you understand that all these governments are corporations, and they're all owned by private individuals, and you look at, you know, the government of the United States is apparently owned by Archbishop Derek R. McLeod, who functions out of the Archdiocese of the Basilica on Michigan and 4th Street in Washington, D.C. We did have a joke about this one, though, JP, that of course, you know why the entire government of the United States is owned by Archbishop McLeod?
I don't know, because they're all Jesuits, no?
No, because there can be only one. And that's the end of Highlander. McLeod, you know, beats everybody else. And what is he, what's the power that he's given? He becomes head of the global corporation. That's, you know, that's part two of the Highlander. Screw all the series stuff and all that other stuff. That's just funny that it was McLeod that actually, it actually owns the United States because he won the wars of the Highlanders.
And he did, so, he made weather control machines, didn't he?
Well, the weather stuff, you know, this is what's going on with the weather, which is very
in
strange.
The film. He was a weather, they did weather control.
Yeah, Highlander 3, there was all weather control machines and all that. If you look at the Highlander, not so much the series, but the movies, they are very prescient of what they start doing and how this group of immortals at the top do start creating, you know, they start creating these weather manipulation machines and all of this. Now, in the United States, it's very weird because, part of what I started talking about I can go on and on and on about this, and I can just show everybody that what we think are catastrophes on the one hand, and because so many people in this movement are, you know, they love scaring you. They love going boo at night. They love getting up there because the more fear you make, the more loot you take. And, you know, oh, buy my survival stuff, or you need bullets, or you need silver, which is kind of a weird... It's sort of a weird philosophy. It's sort of like, you know you're in a prison, but they're going to take your cell last. You know, that's the mentality these people have. Well, I'm going to be out in the woods and the whole world's going to be destroyed, but, you know, they'll kill me last. When you look at what they're going to do with the economy on the one hand, and you understand that the United States is winning, you know, even though the United States is on its knees and we're all in debt and all this other stuff, I point out to people, look, there's 740 people. This is a proven political science fact. There's 740 people that control the stocks for 80% of the wealth in the world. And I would tell you that probably 80% of those people are all U.S. citizens, one way or the other. And if you look at the United States, which is now basically completely controls Mesopotamia through our taking control of Iraq, and that now we control all of Asia Minor for pretty much the next century. If you look at why we went into Afghanistan, because they wiped out the heroin trade, and now we're back in the heroin business, and we're making 100 billion cash, you know, out of Afghanistan, and we're still going to control it through drones and through whatever else. You know, the evil United States is winning, and all these people that are talking about a global collapse, it makes much more sense for the United States to trigger a global economic collapse out there to scare people into getting back into the Federal Reserve note, which we laughingly call the U.S. dollar. I mean, why are all these pipelines? The Saudi Arabians are obsessed with building a pipeline in Syria, which is why they're at odds with Putin and have threatened the Olympics. And Putin, by the way, I mean, when the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia goes to the President of Russia and says, we're going to attack your Olympics. You don't do what we say. We're going to do a bunch of terrorist attacks on your Olympics. I mean, he said this in public. And Putin said, you do that and I will destroy you. I will bomb Mecca. I will destroy your country if you attack our Olympics here. And then suddenly you have all these weird Olympic things happening and all these weird terrorist women, the Black Widows, and all these threats against Sochi. And the whole point of the Saudis trying to topple Assad is that they want to build a pipeline into... And take that pipeline and get their oil and natural gas into France and Western Europe so they can compete with the Russians. And the reason they're all obsessed with pipelines is because all these yabos that are talking about not trading oil in U.S. dollars or petrodollars, they're insane. Because for the first time ever in history, ever, the United States Navy controls two-thirds of the water, two-thirds of the planet. You can't get something from point A to point B without the express permission and protection of the U.S. Navy, which means if you want to ship your oil on a boat, then you better be using U.S. dollars to do it, or you're going to have us to answer to. And the last real naval power was Britain, And in exchange for the Lend-Lease program in England, they gave us the trade routes of the North Atlantic, which means the United States runs everything. So I'm not so worried about the big financial collapse. You will notice that in 2008, when the United States started almost going under, there was massive civil war in China, because if our markets collapse, China goes away. But this has nothing to do with anything. This is all the technocrat stuff. This is all the, or should I say the autocratic stuff, which is all the social junk, which is all corporations warring against each other, and these corporations trying to break down any sort of representative government so that the slaves can't really fight back, so that they can maximize their profits of transferring, of basically shearing the sheep and making sure the wool gets from point A to point B. The technocrats, on the other hand, again, and I've been saying this for a while, they are triggering earthquakes, big earthquakes, I might add, and it's very strange because there is a pattern to the earthquakes, and there was a paper written by Cornell University in 2011, so this is not just me making this up. Cornell University noticed, and this is very interesting, if you take the value of pi, which is 3.14, et cetera, and then you take the illusion of time, and we view the illusion of time in a circle as the face of a clock in 60, or multiplicatives of, actually in base 12, which is the mathematics of the gods in base 12. Not base 10, but base 12. Apparently the gods had 12 fingers and toes. So if you take pi and times it by 60, you come up with 188.88888. You come up with 188.888. It's weird too that Greenwich Mean Time, which was established in England, in Greenwich, outside of London, was established in 1888, which is of course pi times 60 again. Now, if you look at the earthquakes that have occurred, each one of these quakes, major quakes, has occurred in a 188-day cycle, beginning with the earthquakes in the big earthquake, A-plus earthquake in Fiji, and then 188 days later, and you can check this if you want, 188 days later was the Biobío earthquakes in Chile, 188 days later was the Christchurch earthquake in New Zealand, 188 days later was Fukushima, and then you can trace it if you draw a straight line across. Fukushima aligns with San Francisco, and there are all these people that were predicting on that day, the 188 days, which was, I don't know, March of 2011, I think it was, were predicting a huge quake in San Francisco, and instead of San Francisco, you actually had a 7.4 and then a 7.6 on the San Andreas Fault, but in Mexico on that particular day. And the Mexicans, not only were they ready for it, but they had a National Earthquake Preparedness Day on the day. So what are the chances that they advertise this months in advance, and they have all the schools emptied and the hospitals and people wearing hard hats and the whole thing, and suddenly these two big earthquakes hit while they've declared basically a national holiday for National Earthquake Preparedness Day? Yeah, so
they found
somebody
it.
Is out there manipulating the outcomes of all of this, and quite possibly either shifting the timelines or knowing what's coming, are able to create these massively giant events. And each one of these quakes, by the way, has actually altered the nodal axis of the Earth. The Chile earthquake altered it by 6.5 inches. About 5 inches. The Fuji earthquake by also another 5. And the Fukushima earthquake altered the nodal axis of the planet by 6.5 inches. And it took all the pressure off the Cascadia fault line, which means that now by Fukushima happening, which is a 9.3 quake, only 16,000 people dying in a 9.3 quake is pretty friggin' impressive. And then, because now you're saving Vancouver, Victoria, Seattle, Portland, the entire Pacific Northwest. That's just my theory, again, and I'm just pointing out that this is the kind of super technology, a Star Trek level technology, where you're altering planets, if you will, to keep the current system in place. Now, whether or not they can maintain this through this period of time, because something happens between now and 2016, something quite possibly, remember, we're coming up on probably one of the harshest astrological alignments on April 23rd, which is the next big square,
is it?
Of Uranus and Pluto. And
so, Sean.
Yeah.
Sean, there are bladders in the chat room, and certainly in mine, that really need to empty themselves. Thank you. You're amazing, right?
Okay. Are we done?
Can I play a tune while I rush to the bathroom so that everybody else can rush to the bathroom?
No. You must listen to me talk. Shut up. Go ahead. Absolutely not.
I'm going to put the doors on.
I told you to put your Depends on, didn't I?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Do what you do.
Hey, I'm going to play Break On Through to the Other Side. Just as
yay. Don't.
Welcome back to Ever Beyond. Thankfully, there should be a lot less tension in the room. We are able to breathe, relax. Sean, we're ready for more.
Okay.
Lightning speed delivery of... okay, so where were we? We were... Where did we drop the thread?
I don't know. Where did we?
Where were we?
what do you most need to know? I don't know.
Well, I mean, if I could take it back to Ted and
Sands of Time. Sands of Time. All three of my books: Black Seraph, The Dark Prophet, Veil of the Antichrist, and Sands of Time are available on Audible.com. as audiobooks, and you can get them at strangeuniverseradio.com and on amazon.com. We have actually Sands of Time has a 5-star rating on Amazon, amazon.com as an epic.
And is that yourself reading the book out?
Yes, it is me actually speaking. Not as well as you, but more Americanized.
Well, of course, because you're an American and I'm
yes.
I'm a Anglo.
But it is me. It is me doing all the funny voices and all that. So
oh, really?
I sent you a couple of songs in the chat for you to play. So if you want to play those, and actually I'll send you this one too. I sent you Thunderbirds and some other funny things. So I can't believe you sent me this thing on this movie.
this movie. We were talking about weird relationships.
You sent me this. Je t'aime, mon cher. I don't know if I should tell people this, but I can't even find it on Netflix. But you sent me this weird movie about gay garbage men, and the one garbage man falls in love with a girl who only likes like anal sex, and that was disgusting.
Yeah, that's this famous, and he's big in France. He's really big. This film was huge in the early 70s, and that song, Je t'aime, moi non plus, you know, this thing. Yes. Like, everybody slow danced to it when we were kids.
Yeah, generations of
French. That was the thing. If you that was da da da. You, as soon as you knew that, you would sort of look for the bird that you fancied and hear your dance in love. You know,
it was a hit in America too. I heard it in America here as well. So.
Yeah, and it's synonymous with sexual slinkiness and all of that. You know. But it's actually, you know, the real sort of backstory of it is, you know, like you said, it was this very weird sort of this guy who pretends to be a woman who's really a woman who pretends to be a guy or something like that.
No, it was just a girl he meets in a coffee shop, and she is a guy. I mean, she is a girl, but she just looks kind of boyish. Mm. And he's a gay garbage man who falls in love with this girl. No, I'm not even gonna explain this. But actually, I sent you the song, so if you want to, Je t'aime moi non plus, which means I love you, I don't. I guess because she says I love you, and he says I don't love you.
Love you, and yeah, me neither.
I love you, I don't. So that's the song. So. And then I sent you an acoustic version of Baby Got Back by Jonathan Colton.
I think you sent me a couple of these anyway.
Which is hilarious. And then I sent you Thunderbirds or Go too, so you can use that since we're both Thunderbirds fans. From Super Marionation, Stingray and Thunderbirds and Fireball XL5
and
all that
stuff. And Joe 90. Now you see, this is the thing, and let's take it back to our story thread, you know, the secret government. And we have all of these science fiction films, and we've discussed a lot of this before, but things like Joe 90, where there's this boy who gets put in this kind of spinning bubble thing, and he's programmed, and he can do all these things because his mind's been programmed, and he's a 10-year-old boy, 10-year-old boy, right. Is suddenly able to be superhuman being. Yeah. And he's given drugs and hypnosis and blah, 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 blah. And it was a kid's TV show. But wow. that was shit that was going on, man.
Well, the show that predates, and it's completely off topic, but the show that predates all of them, where now you actually, I think the next Johnny Depp movie is called Transcendence. And the show that was so far ahead of its time that predicted everything that's going on now was Max Headroom. Max Headroom is, it's just, you look at Max Headroom now, and, you know, where Edison Carter's working for, Channel 23, and, you know, how his consciousness gets uploaded into a computer, and that computer begins to, you start to take over the society, and it's just really a shame. They should really bring back the concept of Max Headroom.
I love Max Headroom. I downloaded them. I've got a torrent somewhere if anybody wants it. Best sci-fi. I remember it was about 1984 that came out. I remember watching it on TV and thinking, wow, this is something different. Yeah.
So back to Sands of Time. We talked about the underground bases. And we talked about the Dulce War conflict. Mm-hmm. We talked about our proving that the base and the facility was there. We had a woman who... I knew a woman named Krista Tilton who had been abducted and actually taken into the facility, where she saw, you know, people in suspended animation in glass cases, and she was examined while she was at the facility. A Japanese news crew took her above the Dulce Mesa. Remember, this is in the middle of nowhere on a Hickory Apache Indian Reservation, just a little bit south of Durango, Colorado, next to Farmington, actually on the border of New Mexico and Colorado. You know, way, way, way out there. And the point of all this being is that there is, on the one hand, you have a secret government that's in place, and I don't mean to sound like I'm some fan of these guys, and you do have a secret government that's in place that is using super technology and is building and spending all of this money to build an interplanetary, solar system-wide defense grid or system. And I had arguments about this with Mr. Humphrey, when he was around. I began to come in contact with him in the early 90s when I was fooling around with Area 51, and when I found the hilltop that then looked down on Area 51 and filmed it for the first time. In that period of time also, I was contacted by a super soldier who called himself Connor Hennessy, who claims to have escaped from Area 51 with 450 pages of what he called the Holy Grail of documents that were going to blow the lid off this entire thing. And this was at a period of time when I was associated with and was working for Geraldo Rivera. We had a show called Now It Can Be Told, and I was doing some production for him. And this Connor Hennessy called himself Ghost Walker, and he had like 60 confirmed kills. He was an assassin, and he was what they called the secret government's one bullet retirement program. Mm-hmm. And his job was to basically go after people in the government who had either gone rogue or had outlived their usefulness or what have you. And in between hits, he was stationed as a security guard at Area 51, because apparently Area 51 is underground. It's like a gigantic resort. The food is 5-star. They get lobster every day. They get stuff flown in. I mean, you know, the best hotels in Vegas get like the scraps from what they use at Area 51. So it's a primary key assignment. And he supposedly, I'm gonna just tell a brief story of this. He carries out a hit on a guy. He wires his car with a bomb. The guy takes the day off work and decides to take his wife and two daughters to the zoo, gets in the car, Ghost Walker is running towards the car to try to stop the guy. The guy turns the key, blows up, kills his family. And then he's like, I don't want to do this anymore. I want out. And then they tell him he's going to die of Hodgkin's disease, which he doesn't believe. And now he's out and loose. He shows up at Wendell Stevens' house with Wendell Stevens and his and Jim Cox, who is his grandson. And starts telling this whole story about, and you know, the guy was 6'4", muscled like I'd never seen, had a big scar across his face, had gold eyes from the various chemicals that they gave him to enhance intelligence, biology. And he goes through Wendell Stevens, finds out kind of what he knows. Then he goes through Jim Delatoso, Jim swears that he was paralyzed in his house when people went through his home and tore it apart and looking for stuff and what have you. The guy jumped in a car and came out here to Hermosa Beach and shows up at my house. And he's got a former stripper in tow with him, and he's sleeping in my spare room. And Jim Dellatosa calls me and says, this guy's really dangerous. You might want to stay away from him. And I'm like, thanks for telling me now, Jim, because he's sleeping on my couch, and I got a gun under my pillow like every night. Freaking me out, telling me, look, they could come anytime. They can hear us. They know where we are. And I watch this guy do amazing things. I mean, I watch this guy jump. My goodness, from a standing box start, I guess he jumped on top of a lifeguard stand. It was crazy. I mean, he jumped like 20 feet in the air straight up. He could do crazy things like perfect balance. He could balance himself on one hand without moving. It's just, he just did weird stuff. And his whole thing was, we got to go back out to Nevada. Now, he was also trying to get money too. He was trying to get money out of Geraldo Rivera at the same time. But whole long story short, we go back out to Las Vegas. He gives me a key. He tells me to go to this bus station that I need to unlock a locker at the bus station. He's going to go somewhere else to do something else. I go to this bus station, and we're supposed to meet at 3:00 in front of the Flamingo Hotel. And Bob Keviat, who was my producer at Geraldo at the time, who later came out and worked on Unsolved Mysteries with us here. And Bob was the one that I turned on to the alien autopsy footage, which he made all kinds of money on, and pretty much snaked me out of. He told us to all meet in front of the Flamingo Hotel. We had a security team ready. We had tickets. Had a whole crew of guys out there. I go to this bus station with the key, only to find that not only was the locker not there, but the entire row of lockers had disappeared. And I sat there for about an hour with the bewildered bus master trying to figure out where the hell, an entire row of lockers went.
CIA.
And that was it. And that was, and how they snuck these lockers out of there. And I go back to the Flamingo Hotel, and we're sitting there with the security guys and an armed team of guys that are going to put us on a plane and take us back to, which made no sense to me at all, but was going to fly us back to New York, and where then supposedly Connor was going to get paid. And he disappeared, and I never saw him again. And he didn't show up to the Flamingo. Now, a couple of years later, this was 91, mind you, and I knew he was legitimate because I was the only one at that time who had seen Area 51. I was the only one that found the hilltop that looked down on the base and videotaped it. So nobody else had that information at the time. And when I asked him what it looked like, he said, well, the big hangar's here, and this is here, and then there's a road that goes there, and drew a perfect map of the place. So I knew he knew what he was talking about. And I had the unique ability to know whether or not people were BSing me, because I was the only guy that found the hill that looked at the base. And I didn't tell John Lear about it until December, I think, of 91. And then John told everybody on Earth, and then it became a big deal. And then all these other guys move in, and they're like, they become the big experts on it, and I'm pretty much just forgotten in the mix. So, a couple of years later, like 93 or so, this was before the Oklahoma City bombing, I get a call from Wendell Stevens, who tells me that he was in contact with Connor. And I said, what's he up to? He says, well, he's apparently now made some deal with the government. He's back inside. And now he's infiltrating these patriot groups. And he's trying to get them to, blow up a federal building so they can pin it on the right wing or the patriot guys. And, of course, then Oklahoma City was like a year later. And that's exactly the story that we got. And my argument to Wendell was, this guy was never on the run, that the whole thing was fake, that he was going through our network to see what exactly it was that we knew, and he was, he was acting as a double agent the entire time, and pretty data transparent miner. Double agent. I'm sorry, what?
A data miner.
Yeah, an agent provocateur. And you'll notice that virtually every single supposed terrorist attack in the last 13 or 14 years or so, you will find an FBI agent provocateur behind it. They go to meetings. They say, let's do stuff. If you want a bomb, here's a bomb. If you want guns, here's guns. And they're providing these people with stuff that they would never have access to. Even the two guys that supposedly were responsible for the Boston bombing, you discover later that they were both assets of the CIA, that they were both assets of the FBI. And eventually the government turns on these guys. So there it is. Well, Sands of Time, the reason Sands of Time is an important document is it's the one thing that comes from the inside. It's the one thing that is probably one of the greatest, I guess what you would call it, disclosure documents ever. Because the reason I did not publish the journals themselves is that, one, they probably wouldn't have made any sense to You know, you really had to go through it, know the story, and he told me the story, and, you know, if I just published the journals, first off, they'd be unreadable. So what I did is I did what I call novelized nonfiction, which is took the very clear, very powerful story of Ted Humphrey's life from when his father disappears. I mean, he just drives out of the desert and vanishes when he's 17 years old. And he gets involved in all these top secret government projects primarily to find out what happened to his father. So the whole thing really does become a son searching for his dad. And then he goes to USC, graduates, he goes to Caltech, he then gets pulled into the Montauk Project. From there, they send him to Mount Grace to crack Hans Kammler, which he manages to do. And, you know, from there, he goes out to Area 51, to Nevada, and, you know, all the ins and outs of the true people in power who are very real living human beings who are dealing with responsibilities that are, I mean, truly of a global level. You have guys who presidents, popes, prime ministers call sir, and, you know, who would burn down entire sections of their population, you know, on their word, who are tasked with the protection of this planet. And at the same time, with the overall prime directive that at some point in the beginning of the next decade, there is something very big and very bad and very nasty headed this way. And whether or not it's the Alpha Draconians, and I've heard a lot of different things as to who they might be, as to whether or not it's some kind of and it's not that easy to get an armada across the galaxy. It's not Star Wars. You have to, in order to use what they call gravity drives, which are faster than light, but not bending space. They can't just bend time and space, like some other races can. You can't use them in the gravitational fields of solar systems, which means you have to chart around solar systems. And if you get caught in a solar system, you have to use impulse sublight to get through the solar system, which could take years. But apparently they all show up around somewhere at the beginning of the next decade, between like 2021 and 2025. And this is also, let me just tell you how the story dovetails as well. Al Bielek, who claimed to be formerly be a man named Edward Cameron, and his brother Duncan Cameron, and then Preston Nichols, and this whole crew, which Peter Moon writes these books about. I knew Al Bielek for years. And, you know, it was very sad in his latter days. I was sending him money and trying to help him out. And nothing Al ever told me about the secret government ever turned out to be untrue. Everything I could check. And Al claimed he and his brother Duncan were the two guys on the USS Eldridge who flipped the switch. And that when the Eldridge went screaming through time, they jumped off the boat and they wound up in the year 2139. And that they were there for 6 months or so before they were then sent back in time to stop the Eldridge from ripping apart the fabric of time space, I guess. And Al was the one that was also telling me that there was something on its way. And my wife's home. You may have to play a song while I help her with some things. That something was on its way, and that we went toe to toe with this reptilian race. And that, and again, if you look at the Book of Revelation, the very end of the Book of Revelation is a war between Michael, the blonde archangels, if you will, versus the great dragon. And Michael is wounded, and they cast the dragon to Earth. Well, this is exactly what Bielek was saying, that the Pleiadians go at it with the Alpha Draconians, that they trick them into a kind of a pincer movement, if you will, to commit their forces to Earth, and then they seal off the Earth and trap them here. And then it's our problem. According to Bielek, there's this big war that rages, and we win it using some kind of sonic weapons or something. But he told me this stuff way back in late 80s, I think it is, late 80s, early 90s or so. And then to have Ted Humphrey come from the other side and say, well, yeah, that's pretty much true. And that's why we're spending trillions of dollars to build this defense system, with me going, well, it sounds to me like another fake Russian-Chinese Cold War that the guys at top are just using to, you know, to spend all this money. But then it gets weird too, because if you check out information from, one of the websites that I made popular was a website called, the Wingmakers. And the Wingmakers, which we revealed in, which came out in like 96, 97 or so, the core of Wingmakers was that there was a group called the Advanced Contact Intelligence Organization, and that that they wanted to develop time travel, what they called blank slate time travel technology, to stop a race of beings that were coming from galaxy M51 that they called the Animas, that they called the Lucifer galaxy, because that was the galaxy where they tried to start life using silicone rather than carbon. Can you play a song for me real quick while I drag some stuff up from the car?
Sure.
Okay, and just
we're
pick something and I'll be,
Lovers of Light.
Be back in about 4 minutes.
Okay. Open the gates. Lovers of Light by Afro-Celt. Here on Wolf Spirit Radio, noborders.co.uk and everbeyond.info/radio. We welcome back Sean David Morton, who's done his little schlepping from the car.
Thank you, sir. My wife just came back from a cat show where our cats won all kinds of
prizes.
Yes, we breed and show championship Norwegian forest cats, and they just won big championships today. So they're very fluffy and very very happy with
them. Oh, all fluffed up and primped.
Yes,
well, primped. anyway, so yeah, I used to go. I used to have a girlfriend who did the dog show thing, and so I've been in that world. It's to me, the dog shows, the cat shows must be much cooler, because the dog shows they're always in gyms and things like that has that 1 kilohertz resonance, and they're all barking away, and it really did my head in just to go in this atmosphere. I'm sure the cat shows are much calmer affairs. Are they quieter, or are they?
No, Norwegian forest cats are they're great. They're amazing.
Beautiful, so nice vibrations. So. Anyway, So meanwhile, we were halfway through the the first chapter of Sands of Time. No, so we've done the bases and.
The overall gist of it, and this is interesting, where Sands of Time dovetails into other things. For example, with Phil Schneider, I went back and after I wrote the book, I looked at Phil Schneider, a number of lectures he did on the web, only to realize that what seemed completely insane at that time, Schneider was not only was he absolutely right, but he was one of the mole men that then blew out the tunnel that found things underneath Dulce, which then led to the Dulce war and or conflict. It goes into Al Bielek and Preston Nichols and, Duncan Cameron and their idea of supposedly seeing the future from 2139 and then seeing this war with this reptilian race in the early 2020s. It was interesting how it related to the Wingmaker information. Now, whether or not Wingmakers was a myth or was a website that was just put up by Mark Hempel, Carrie Cassidy from Project Camelot actually owned the rights to Wingmakers to do as a film. And, we attempted something. I mean, Mark Hempel and whomever wrote a screenplay about it, and it was terrible. It was just a steaming pile of shite. It was 220 pages, and the girl dies at the end, and it's just, it was just terrible. Ach, the poo, as they say. They would say in Scotland, ach, the poo. So I tried to rewrite something, and I had a whole idea for it. And the weird thing about Wingmakers was that Wingmakers got me in a lot of trouble investigating it, because the guy who was the head of the Advanced Contact Intelligence Organization, they described as a rather short man, about 5'4" or so, with silver hair, wore silver suits and sneakers, and that this guy was head of a global organization called the Incunabula, which is a Latin term which means nest. It really means clutch of vipers' eggs or nest of serpents, and it's one of the things that Jesus used as he said, "Oh, thou whited sepulchre, thou nest of vipers." That he talked about the Sanhedrin being the sons of Shaitan, the serpent god, and it was really weird because you find out, and his name in the contact information for Wingmakers was just 15. And that he was kind of head of this board that would meet. And then you find out that Incunabula then does link into the Bilderbergers, because that's the real name of the Bilderbergers behind the scenes. I looked into a company called Omnigon was the name of the company, and I mentioned it on the radio because I looked into Omnigon, as Omnigon was they were going to release they have this alien technology from a group they call the Cortium. And they then integrated into the corporate structure. And apparently 15 was the guy that was responsible for doing that. And Omnigon was one of these companies that was going to release a form of alien mathematics. This was like, remember, this is 96, 97. A form of alien mathematics, like alien algebra, calculus, that was going to speed up broadband speeds by something like, you know, 10, 15 times, which is what we're looking at now. The main scientist who defected from the program was a guy by the name of, Jameson Neruda. Jameson Neruda was the main guy. Well, I knew people that knew Jameson Neruda. I knew a woman who was an anthropological archaeologist who had two skeletons in the Met in New York, who said, yeah, I know Jameson Neruda. He's an expert on Mesoamerican languages and tribes. And he was brought into the ACIO because they found this football-shaped device in a secret set of caves in Chaco Canyon in New Mexico that was all part of the Chaco Canyon development, and Chaco Canyon is really amazing because if you look at Mesoamerica, you have a burst of creativity that happens around the 8th century AD, or, you know, from about 750 AD until about 900 AD. All this crazy stuff happens. You have, for example, you have the post-classical pyramids of Chichen Itza. You have the perfect city in Chaco Canyon that's all built on straight lines. That's an exact astronomical description of a 5,000-year cycle of the moon. It's just, I mean, you have all these crazy things that happen. And then the technology just disappears. You know, it lasts for about 150 years or so, and then it just vanishes, as if just ETs just landed, did all this stuff, and then just, you know, sat back and looked at it for a while, and then went away. And in the Wingmakers material, they say that these beings at first they thought were extraterrestrial, but turned out to be from the future, specifically the 29th century, were coming back in time and assisting us. And the main reason they were assisting us is because they needed the Earth to ascend. They needed the Earth to activate, and that there were time sons that were actually stored in seven areas around the Earth that, if they were properly activated, would assist humanity in the upward ascension. And that should we ascend, that the vibratory frequency of the planet would rise to such a level that when the Animos got here, this, you know, anti-race from galaxy M51, that we would be able to, that they couldn't attack us, that they wouldn't notice us, or we would sour the milk, so to speak. Well, 15 and the ACIO didn't want to have anything to do with that. They didn't want humanity to ascend. They didn't want humanity to rise up because they would lose control over them. So what they wanted to do was time travel into something they called blank slate technology, to go back to a point in time where we were noticed by this alien race and simply find a way to alter that perception so that this giant eye just looks at us and kind of looks away and the invasion never happens. But that means you have to go out into the ocean and find when a particular wave starts and stop all the elements behind that wave hitting the shore, which is immensely complicated and quite possibly could unravel all reality. So it was just weird that all this stuff is all coming together. I thought it interesting that the 29th century beings that were coming back to visit us, they called them the Wingmakers because humanity at this future point is operating on a 12 chakra energy system that has to do with literally a wing energy that comes out of the back. And then I started meditating on this and started feeling the whole activation of not just seven chakras, but a 12 chakra system that actually includes a wing energy that actually comes out of the back that I learned how to ignite and work with people. And as far as sense of time goes, you have one man's perspective of being drawn into these secret programs, of being vetted by these programs, and eventually becoming a leader in these programs. And when I got the contact notes, for lack of a better term, I was never told he died. I was told that he, quote, moved on. The last I heard from him was January of, I think, 2009. It was January 2009. It was actually Obama's inauguration, and he called me from the platform in front of the Capitol building because he was laughing his head off because Obama had screwed up the presidential oath. And I had predicted in an article about a month before that Obama was going to find a way to screw up the oath because he's not a citizen and he couldn't put his hand on the Bible and properly take the Article 6 oath Now, he could sign the papers and become the corporate head of the USA, but not president of the republic and take the oath. Now, of course, he's done that. Now that he's stacked the Supreme Court, he knows nobody's going to do anything to him. But anyway, so I bet this guy, like, money that Obama would find a way to screw the oath up, and he called me and was laughing. I could hear him laughing on the TV, and he's talking to me on the phone. And that was the last I heard of him until I was contacted by this, these very spooky lawyers who said, you can't tell anybody's name, and I told you wouldn't know it anyway. But it's one of those things where I think the last time one of these major guys was in the paper was the character in the book Harvey Gilson had a funeral that did make the papers where Bill Clinton came and all that. But again, the point of the book was the development of all of this behind the scenes technology, as the setup really for book two. And, my big challenge is that I'm going to this big literary conference in another couple of weeks. And, I've been talking to, a man by the name of Rick Frischman, who represented Frank Herbert, who did Dune and Mr. Canfield from, Chicken Soup for the Soul. And he's one of the big literary guys that if I can actually get some representation, then, I'm going to start publishing. I'll put out book two and book three and, all that's left in the notes, because it's just such crushing work. And I've sold, thousands of copies of Sands of Time in hardback already, because the book has become just such a gigantic cult bestseller. And when I ran out of my first or second printing of it, it was selling for $350 on the internet because so many people wanted the book, which I think is kind of fun. So eventually, if I ever get back on, some show like Coast to Coast AM with, Mr. Norrie and get back on that program again, I'm hoping the book will sell a lot more. So there it is. I don't know what else to talk about, but it's the secrets of the universe and how we develop this technology. And, the unified field theory is in the book. And I actually got a patent on the unified field theory for use as the grounds for a superluminal communication system, which could possibly be, and what we can do is a complete cell phone structure that needs no infrastructure, that can communicate, you can communicate with anybody, anywhere, instantaneously, anywhere in the galaxy. I mean, that's what's next. That's the next level of what, 10G is eventually going to be.
Yeah. And you just stick your finger in your ear.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah. Exactly. But watch out when the fax comes through.
Anyway, meanwhile, well, excellent, Sean. Thank you very much.
Chat room people, or are they just stunned into submission, or questions in the chat room?
Oh, no, they're enjoying it. They're curious, there's one person who's almost like taking notes of what you were saying, and it was like a paragraph of these very phrases. You're going to need decoding. I mean, you and I, we go back weeks. Right. But, we've kind of, from the same generation and kind of primed, I'm primed very much to hear what you've got to say. And there are other people like me.
Thank you.
A lot of us are in the chat room, and we're on three streams, and there are listeners on all three, and...
Okay.
There's a good bubbling. So, the other thing is that you do an audio book. Do you read the book out yourself with your own voice?
Yeah. I was just completing. We have my first two books, Black Seraph and The Dark Prophet. There was a character I created called Father Dominic Lindquist, who's half Bedouin and half Irish, and he's a priest for the Catholic Church who works for the Jesuits. And it was a way for me to kind of get inside the infrastructure of the Catholic Church and, show what that whole world is all about. And, book one is my character, Dominic Lindquist, who steals the plans for a genetic weapon and is then hunted by all of the various intelligence services on the planet, and he makes himself a target primarily to expose an assassination attempt by a group of Nazis within the Catholic Church who this is all 2004. This is before Ratzinger took over as Der Führer, who was a former Nazi, or at least a Hitler Youth anyway. And, so this whole, as predicted in his book, this whole clique of the church managed to kind of take things over. Then when Ratzinger came to power, my character is on the outs, and he gets exiled to this monastery in France. And it's from there, Pope John Paul II gives him a papal bull that says there's a rising force, the third Antichrist that was predicted by Nostradamus. I mean, all you need is one leader to arise with what's called the Book of Truth, which was another book written by Muhammad, not the Quran. But Muhammad actually supposedly wrote two books, the Quran and something else called the Alienation of the Rose, also known as the Book of Truth, which then disappears in 1195 AD, which is then when the Muslim fortunes all kind of turn, and which is absolutely true. So a guy in Iran finds the Book of Truth and puts on a white veil as prophesied. So I took all the prophecies of Nostradamus and all the prophecies of the Quran about the 12th Iman, the Mahdi, Al-Muqawana, this veiled prophet, and what would happen with the internet and with everything else connecting the world. And by the way, completely predicted. And this is 2009 when I wrote this book, and there's a scene in the book where a guy's getting beaten up in Tunisia selling fruit, and he lights himself on fire to protest it, and it gets shown on YouTube and Facebook, and people videotape it, and it starts this entire revolution across the Middle East. And I had a publisher tell me that that's the most ridiculous thing he's ever heard as a premise for a book, and it's exactly what happened a year later or so, which then triggered the whole Arab Spring. So you have something that predicts the future in the book that then the book's right there on the spot. And I was praying and hoping that if I got popular with it, that I'd get Liam Neeson, or I know Pierce Brosnan actually fairly well, and I wanted Pierce to be able to do this, but he was kind of tired of the whole spy thing. And I was just finishing up the audio on that, and then Sands of Time is also comes in audio as well. And I read and perform the books, and you know, which is quite a, you know, Sands of Time is quite a long book. So it's a lot easier to listen to, and I might take your suggestion that when I do the paperback that I might just split the book into two paperbacks and put bigger print in it for, you know, poor old guys like us to read. So Sands of Time, they're all available on audible.com and, strangeuniverseradio.com is our website, or SeanDavidMorton.com. And, also we're on, JP is gracious enough to produce my program and co-host my show with me on Wednesdays, on Strange Universe. And our ratings came out. I guess we're like the number two biggest talk show on the web. We're beating Alex Jones now pretty handily. So I guess his form of crazy is starting to kind of fade.
Well, and you know, Alex is. I never liked his cheeks.
No, Alex is. You know, he's valuable. He makes a lot of money with the fear and the panic, and all these conservative talk show hosts have blind spots with. You know, with Sean Hannity, you call him and say, you know, what about the Bilderbergers? And he'll go, I don't know what you're talking about. Never heard of them. Click, hang up on you. With Glenn Beck or Art Bell, you call them and say, what about 9/11? Ah, you're a wingnut. If you don't think Arabs crash planes into buildings, you're crazy. Alex Jones, it's like, you know, anything that has to do with the Israelis, because I guess he's funded by Bronfman money. You know, and Edgar Bronfman just died, and, you know, his wife is Jewish, which is something that he kind of covers up, and, he's all up in an organization called Stratfor, which is basically the Mossad. It's all, you know, it's the Debka file, which is all kind of, it's the Mossad. It's kind of the Mossad high school newspaper, sort of. So, you know, and it's all very anti-Arab and very pro-war, and I'm not any of those things. And I've lived in Arab countries, and I've really never met a Muslim that I can tell you that I don't like. But you get out into the radical parts where, you know, the great Satan and all that is, you know, you get the radical Islam, which I think is what's showed to us on the press. It's, so I don't know where it's going to go. I mean, I know that we're coming up on this year is going to be whatever's going to happen in April. We've got about probably between now and the better part of 2015 to sort of get our financial stuff together. And then everything is just going to start to collapse and hit the bottom somewhere between about 2018 and about 2020. And we have these Pluto-Uranus squares. We had five Pluto-Uranus squares between 1930 and 1933. We had three of them in the 1960s with JFK, RFK, and MLK, and all being assassinated, and then the Tet Offensive and the Vietnam War and all that. But we have seven of these squares that are happening between 2012 and 2015. So the period of time we're in, especially with Pluto in Capricorn, which is undermining everything, governments, constitutions, banking institutions, finances, It's like Pluto, the king of the underworld, with this giant sky that's just, you know, underneath the government, just, you know, hacking away, undermining everything. And then you've got Uranus in Aquarius, which is computers, atomic energy, sudden attacks. But it's like your grandpa in his diaper, who's crazy, running around your house with a gun. It's just Uranus and Aquarius is so radically shifting. You know, this year you're going to see, you're going to see hackers, and the whole Occupy movement is going to come to the forefront yet again. The square that's going to happen April 21st, 22nd, 23rd is going to take out government structures and political and economic collapses. And a lot of big things are coming down. Thank you. I guess we're over.
We got to go. Thank you so much. I'll see you on Wednesday. Thank you very much, my friend.
Thank you, boss. And hey, let's get Paul Hellyer to come on the show.
That'll be cool. He's head after the books.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody. Beyond.